Welcome to Off the Page. It's great to be with you. Today's guest is Sister Rosemary Stets, a Bernardine Franciscan sister who recently authored the book Franciscan Field Guide, People, Places, Practices, and Prayers. Sister Rosemary has served as Vice President for Mission at Alvernia University in Reading, Pennsylvania, and she was a member of the faculty in the Department of English and Communications. Her book, Franciscan Field Guide, is the focus of this conversation. It's a really wonderful book, almost like a Franciscanism 101, with so many on-ramps to different aspects of the tradition. I loved hearing Sister Rosemary's story, discussing her book, and I found her passion for higher education and the love she has for her students to be really inspiring. Our Franciscan Lexio segments today, our reflection segments that we began implementing with the last episode, they are brought to you by Darlene Prides. Dr. Darlene Prides is Franciscan Media's acquisitions editor and a scholar on lay Franciscans. I feel like I learn something new from her every week working with her at Franciscan Media, and I'm happy that you get the chance to learn from her this episode as well. So, without further ado, here is Sister Rosemary Stets. Sister Rosemary Stets, welcome to Off the Page.
Thank you, Stephen. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. I want to get into your wonderful book, The Franciscan Field Guide. It's a concise but comprehensive overview of the Franciscan tradition. But first, can you talk to me a little bit about your own personal journey? What was your upbringing like, and how did you find yourself entering religious life?
That's a lot of territory, but I'll start. I'm Catholic, of course, raised Catholic, and I attended parochial school. And as a child, I always loved writing, and I enjoyed, and I had a very good teacher, Sister Bernardine, sister, in the seventh grade. I'll never forget her, Sister Lillian, who taught me the skill of writing. I don't know if it impacted the class as much as it did to me, but it just made so much sense how to bring out ideas and put them on paper. Then I entered the congregation after high school, and I had my education through the sisters. And I taught elementary school for a few years, which was not a good fit for me. I loved the children, but it wasn't my level, you know. I kept thinking, are they understanding what I'm saying? So then, and also the range of subjects. I hated math. I didn't like science. I was not interested in some of those areas. So by the time I was about 28, I had already finished graduate school, and I was assigned to the university in Reading, which is my the sister sponsor of the university, Alvernia. At that time, it was Alvernia College, and my field was it was English and Communications. So I had the yearbook, and I had the student newspaper, and I taught courses. And I had a wonderful mentor. She was the academic dean, Sister Pacelli, renowned in the congregation as a brilliant woman. She was actually an actress before she entered. She had planned to go toward a degree in theater and, you know, try her luck in theater and Broadway, maybe. But she mentored me, and she would check my syllabus, and she would offer ideas. Her classes were packed to the gills, and I kind of modeled myself on what her style was. So that's how I got my start. And writing always was part of my nature. I journaled all the time, kept a diary. So that's where my domain, you could say, is.
Yeah. Now, some listening may not be familiar with your religious order. Can you explain to listeners what a Bernardine sister is?
Okay. That I know. That's brilliant. I am a Bernardine Franciscan sister. Our official title is Bernardine Sisters of the Third Order of St. Francis. And just by way of a comment, the Third Order is the largest Franciscan order in the world. The Third Order is both regular, meaning myself, you know, we live in a convent, we take public vows and we live the vows, or it could be secular. Secular Franciscans are men and women who live in the world, and they have a job, they have a family, but they are committed to the Franciscan way of life, and they love that life. Just as an aside, my mother was a secular Franciscan, as was her mother. And my paternal father's brother was a secular Franciscan. And he was in the Second World War, and he was killed in action. But when they sent the tags back to my grandmother in the little box, you know how they would do that after, you know, when they buried the body and they sent the tags back? In there was the cord that he wore around his waist that symbolized his commitment to the Third Order ideals. So the Bernardine Franciscan sisters follow the Third Order rule of St. Francis, which is a rule that, you know, is built on the three vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience. And we are also an active order. So we live a life in common, but we have, like, I work at this university in Reading, Alberta. I work along with other sisters of campus ministry, but I had also been a faculty member. And there was a period of time where I served even in administration. So it's actually, as a Bernardine sister, you were sent wherever they want you to be, and you go, and God gives you the help that you need to fulfill that mission.
You talked about your journey and your connection with Alvernia University. And my understanding is that the idea for you to write this beautiful book came in some way from your experiences, interactions with students and faculty at Alvernia. Can you describe the story there and talk about where exactly this book came from within you?
Yes, this book is, I never said to myself, I think I'll write a book about St. Francis. I'll call it this. It'll be this, you know, and then it wrote itself because it called me. What happened in terms of the text itself is, well, I was working at Alvernia. At that time, I was already a faculty member as well as part of the administration. And some of the roles I had were to integrate the Franciscan spirit into the university, because at that point, many of the sisters who had been teachers were now retiring and moving, you know, or they had health issues. I was the youngest probably the whole time I was there. And then at the same time, more and more lay teachers were being hired. And so the administration said, I talked it over with the president and our congregation, which sponsors this university, that we need to, as the sisters disappear and the lay instructors and teachers and professors come in, they're good teachers in their discipline, but they don't have the spiritual background. They don't have the religious sense of a Franciscan university. So I took on my own, you know, to meet new faculty coming in, to explain to them our mission. What is our mission? And how do we live it? The mission for Alvernia: to learn, to love, to serve. You can stop any student on this campus and they can tell you that. And it was really a lay president who was a deacon in the Catholic Church. He was the first lay person to be, after a sister, to become president. And his idea was he wanted to put the San Damiano cross, which is the Franciscan cross of Christ from Italy, from the Middle Ages, in every classroom. And we did. And from there, we began to tell a story of St. Francis to students and to the new faculty coming in. And after 4 years, every faculty member knew the story. And then we began to invite the students to share, you know, at different times, the story of St. Francis as part of the curriculum. Or the faculty member would invite me in as a speaker, and I would just do some little thing on the Franciscan tradition. So it began to grow this way. So at some point, I said to myself, you know, I think that I want to leave something behind if I move on. And so I was going to create a kind of small chapbook, you know, that they could carry or that could be distributed at the beginning of school, at the academic year, with terms and words and sayings and ideas and all the thing about the three orders and all of that. So I started to put something together. And at that time, I took a sabbatical. It was only one semester. I had the opportunity to go to St. Bonaventure. And I had two courses. I think I put this in something that I sent to you, maybe, Stephen. I took two courses from Michael Blastic, who was a tremendous professor, steeped in the tradition, and he spoke at many AFCU conferences, and we were always a success. I asked him if he would read what I was writing. So I was taking notes in his class, and then I was building the content for the book. And I asked him to read it, and he critiqued it, and he gave excellent suggestions. And then I was putting it together. Sister Margaret Carney at that time was president, and I was telling her about the text, and she said, "Oh, that's a great idea. That belongs to a lot of, we have over 20 schools that are Franciscan. We can use that in other schools." I said, "Oh, okay. Never thinking that that would be something that I would pursue. I also have to give credit to a colleague here, Sister Roberta McKelvey, who at that time was at Bonaventure, and she then was back at Alvernia, and we were talking. She was editor of the Cord, and she did a tremendous job putting it together with me. We were in the middle of a general chapter, and we were doing the editing in between sessions. But I met the deadline, and it got published.
I know a lot of people who are spiritually searching. You know, a lot of either recovering Catholics or recovering Protestants who are perhaps calloused or a little bit frustrated with organized religion. However, they find themselves not wanting to let go of the Christian tradition, and they still feel like there's something there. In Franciscanism, to me, it can be that on-ramp for people because, I mean, Francis, of course, was this kind of guy on the margins, Claire as well. They never turned their back on the church. They never turned their back on organized religion. However, it seems as if they were going places that no one else would go, perhaps. And so all that to say, I mean, most people just know St. Francis from bird baths. You know, I know Richard Rohr has talked about that. Perhaps a lot of people have not even heard of St. Clair. And that's what I love about this book, is that it's like a Franciscanism 101, in a sense. And I'm just wondering, how would you explain the Franciscan tradition to perhaps a student or a faculty member that you mentioned, or a listener to this podcast who is curious to learn more about this expansive tradition that you write about in this book?
Well, you know, as you were speaking, Stephen, the idea, well, why is Francis so attractive? Why do people gravitate to him? What's his draw? I remember this struck me, not just necessarily with writing the book, but another name for Francis in the Middle Ages, I guess, was they called him Alter Christus, another Christ. I think the draw for Francis, the draw that he pulls people to himself, is that he was like Christ. I mean, in his lifetime, there were 5,000 men who became Franciscan. 5,000! I mean, that's, you know, they just were. Now, of course, it was at a time when the church was not... you know, they were not exemplary. They did not reach out to the people. They didn't care, really. I mean, they were the clergy, and they were the hierarchy, and they were preserving the you know, the whole tradition handed down from Christ. But maybe they didn't understand, you know, what God would have wanted from them. But they spoke Latin. I remember reading one part where in the church there would be a huge platform. And on that platform would be the altar, and all the clergy would be up there, and they would be celebrating the liturgy, and they would be talking, you know, in Latin, and the people on the floor, you know, 25 steps lower, could hardly hear them, could not understand them. They made no effort to communicate anything to them. And that's why Francis had such a hard time with the clergy. They wanted to brush him out, you know, brush him away. It's like an annoying fly. You know, we know what we're doing. But the people had no connection with God. They were like lost sheep, and Francis was like their shepherd. And I think that he drew people through his authenticity, but he was also charismatic. I mean, you know, he was a short little guy, from what I hear. But he had a great voice. He sang. He expressed himself, and he was a healer. He healed people. Um, he, he he talked to animals. You know, I tell us, when I talk to the students, I tell them some of these stories and their eyes are like big saucers, you know, that I tell them our mascot here at Alverni is the Wolf of Gubbio. And I tell them the story of the Wolf of Gubbio and how Francis tamed the wolf. And then there's one little piece that I remember. I think it might have been Michael Blastic, who gave us that story. But there was an earthquake in Italy, and the church crumbled, and they were repairing it. And in the basement, when they were digging out, excavating and enlarging, they found hidden in the basement, at the bottom of the basement, the bones of a wolf.
Really? I did not know that.
Yes. The bone.
Wow.
And when I tell that story to the students, they look at me like a light goes on in their eyes. Like, he really did talk to animals. Birds would be chirping, and he would say, be quiet now because I'm talking to the people. They would shut up. And then when it was finished, they'd start chirping. I mean, these are the stories, these little flowers of St. Francis that sometimes the academics or maybe clergy, I don't know, would look down on because they're all such cute little stories. There's depth there that we have to recognize. There's real depth. And if they open their eyes and listen to what he's saying and what he did, I mean, he walked through the town and people walked right after him. They were magnetized. They followed him like the sheep would follow a shepherd.
We are about to move into our first reflection moment where we pause, consider, and contemplate the contents of what a guest has said. And again, guiding us through our reflections today is Dr. Darlene Prides.
Francis of Assisi is one of the most popular saints of our Catholic tradition. He's popular among Catholics, among Christians of all stripes, and even among people of other faith or people who do not hold a faith. So we have to ask ourselves, why is he so popular? What is it about Francis that makes him appeal to so many different people? I think for me, one of the most attractive parts of Francis's identity and his way of being is his capacity to be deeply present with other people, deeply present with all of creation, and even deeply present with himself. Now, this might sound pretty easy to do, but in our very fast-paced, distracted world in which we live, it might be something simple but not easy to be deeply present with one another and even with ourselves. And I'm going to start off with my favorite image, and that is the bird bath Francis, because after all, especially scholars like to poke fun at the bird bath Francis as if it's superficial or not serious enough. Now, I don't have a bird bath, but I do keep a little statue of Francis on my desk. Why? Because I love the gentle look that he offers the birds in his hands. And I'm a big fan of bird baths, actually. Again, I'm going to ask why, and that is because when birds congregate on a bird bath, it actually draws my attention in. I actually look at them more deeply. I become delighted by the way they wash themselves in the water of the bird bath. I'm more deeply present with birds when they're in the bird bath, when I can focus on their activities there. So I think something about the quality of Francis's presence with other creatures, as even depicted in a bird bath, I think there's a deep lesson for us. Do we actually see what's in front of us? Are we actually present with what's in front of us? I'll admit, sometimes I need a tool. And for me, a bird bath is a great tool because I'm fascinated by the birds when they come to the bird bath. So I'm all about putting aside the disparaging comments about Francis and the bird bath, but I would like to move on from that quality of presence to some of the stories that are told about Francis. And I think that's another compelling aspect of Francis of Assisi. Sure, there's a lot of theology that gets developed around Francis and Franciscan spirituality. But Francis himself was pretty simple. He wasn't a theologian. We know about him through stories and storytelling. and how we tell these stories, how we enter into the stories closely enough so that we can capture the essence or the meaning of the stories, that's a spiritual practice that I like to live into and have been developing in my own faith journey. So I'd like to start off with the story of the Wolf of Gubbio. It's a relatively popular story about the people of the town of Gubbio who were terrorized by a wolf that was attacking their livestock and even attacking their children. They wanted to seek revenge and kill the wolf. You can see even how I'm telling the story, there's a lot of energy and a lot of volatile energy in part in this story. They were stymied in their efforts to kill the wolf. And in fact, they sought another way to approach this challenging situation and sought Francis to bring in a mode of peacemaking. He had a reputation for brokering peace. So they called him to town. He arrived and he heard their stories and he sensed their fear. He sensed their agitation. And he sensed their anger. He observed all of this. He was present to it, but he didn't react to it. He didn't respond in like manner to it. He himself did not become volatile. Itself, I mean, I think is enough of the story for us to enter into. How often do we get captured in by the energy of a group of people around us or even a single individual? Do we allow someone else's anger to affect us and make us angry? In this story, Francis moves into the woods to find the wolf, putting aside the people of Gubbio for a while. He eventually, again, this is legend, so as the legend goes, Francis finds the wolf in the woods, and he approaches the wolf gently, tenderly, so that he can observe the wolf and be deeply present. And he asks the wolf, "Why are you doing this?" Out of curiosity, he asks, "Why are you scaring the people of Gubbio? Why are you attacking their livestock? Why are you attacking their children?" Again, that just causes us to stop and pause for a moment. How often do we cultivate curiosity around someone else's anger or around someone else's behavior? Can we stop and ask why? Rather than being drawn into perhaps volatile or negative energy. So again, as the legend goes, the wolf responded by saying, "I've lost my pack. I'm all alone. I'm hungry. I need to eat. I'm afraid." All perfectly legitimate reasons for sustaining his own life, right? So Francis brokers a deal and says, "What if the people of Gubbio fed you, offered you a place to live and fed you? Would you stop attacking them?" And according to legend, the wolf said yes. So Francis and the wolf walk back into the town of Gubbio, and you can imagine the shock of the people when they walk into town. But Francis explains and asked the people of Gubbio, "Would you be willing to feed the wolf?" And when they agree, according to legend, the people and the Wolf of Gubbio lived in peace for the next 3 years until the wolf died. This story for me points out so many different simple but maybe not easy features of navigating conflict. Most of all, deep listening to the issues involved and cultivating a sense of curiosity around those issues to ask, to investigate, and to consider a solution that is other than detrimental or violent. Certainly, we need skills like this today where we can enter into a volatile crowd or even enter into a conversation with one volatile person, and rather than receive that volatility or anger ourselves, listen deeply and respond with curiosity.
That reminds me of a great quote in your book. You write, for Franciscans, the focus or gaze is not upward, but rather outward,
yeah,
toward ordinary human life.
Yes.
Can you explain for our listeners what you mean by this and how the Franciscan way opens this up for us?
Okay. I think I take it from the example of the Lord Jesus, who referred to, of course, God our Father, and taught the Lord's Prayer, and understood that our real destiny is to return to the Father. But he knew that it was not going to be just me doing that. I'm not going to go myself. He wanted others to go with him. And so that's why he was sent. God sent him to bring the world, to bring all of creation back into the arms, the loving arms of the Father. And the whole sense, I mean, there's just, it could be so much to talk about. It's like a million threads, but you have to bring them all together and weave it so that you get the story right. But from beginning of time, I mean, you know, wherever we are in the Bible or wherever we are in the human, evolution of human life, at some point, men and women began to look for something above their just survival. And as that began to grow, they felt a longing to know more, and there was an empty. So by the time we come to the Middle Ages, the church, which should have been feeding that hunger, was missing the boat. You know, they hadn't gotten it yet. But Francis, in his humility and in his simplicity and in his, God chose him to be the one that would be the man who would change the world. And he had his own trial. He was a rich man. He was a rich young man, wealthy, had a wonderful life, you know, ran around. His father gave him everything he wanted. He was his favorite. And he wanted to go to war. Sure, you can go to war. I want a horse. Here's the horse. Here's the saddle. Here's everything you need. And of course, they lost the battle and he was captured and he almost died. And that 1 year, his father had to ransom him, and it took a while. But by the time he came out, he knew, I'm on the wrong path. I have to go the other way. And then you have those stories about he was repulsed by lepers, and he forced himself to get down off the horse and go over and kiss the leper. I'm getting a little bit of a drift here, but there's a course we have at Alvernia. It's called Search. I have mentioned it to you before, Stephen. It's a course on how students prepare to get really serious about college education. And I teach, I speak to every single class of students who are all freshmen. Maybe there would be about 300 students over a range of 25 classes in a semester. And I give the same thing to every class, but it's all based on the Franciscan tradition. And when I tell them some of these stories, they just hang on every word. I can see that in them. There is someone underpinning all this with the education, and they recognize a culture at Alvernia that is really unique. There's a spirit here. There's a kindness here. There is a searching sense of what's my destiny and what can I do with my life? Not just my degree, go out and get a job. What's my life going to be about? So I think that this is how Francis impacted people.
And yeah.
That's the key to his popularity.
Yep. Yeah. And I mean, you're mentioning like the young people who you interact with every day, who are spiritually hungry. And I mean, to go back to one of the visuals you gave about people in a church in the Middle Ages, either unable to understand the Latin in some places or unable to hear the liturgy. And I think that's the way a lot of people feel. And yet, here are figures like Francis coming along and saying like, hey, look out at the world. Christ is there. You know, look out at the person you rejected. Christ is there.
Exactly.
Look at your pet. You know, my dog's on the other end of this camera. Like, Christ is there. And
yeah,
this very human person inviting people to see And to realize that the church is everywhere, while also not turning his back on the church. I mean, it's the ultimate non-dualistic move. It's brilliant. But all that to say, I'm wondering, with the young people you interact with every day and these people who are hungry, spiritually searching, how do you believe that the Franciscan way can help to rebuild the church today?
That's an excellent question. Actually, Stephen, that's something that I pray about a lot. You know, I think Francis shows us how. Francis never intended to, you know, he didn't wake up when his father ransomed him from the prison and he came home and he was like walking around adrift in the city and his buddies would say, come on, Francis, let's go drinking, you know, let's go down to the local bar. No, not tonight. And they could, what happened to you? Well, they chalked it up to being in prison or, you know, maybe his health isn't great or whatever. But Francis had, he was a chosen soul. Francis was authentically enwrapped and, you know, attracted to God. And he just grew and grew and God poured and poured more graces into his soul. And the more he received from God, the more he gave out. And so Francis became, he affected society just by his person. And all he wanted to do was live like Christ. And that's why when I will go back to the term I used in the beginning, an alter Christus. I want to be you on this earth. And just as Jesus walked along and chose one and chose another, and then they all started to meet the people, and he began to tell them about God and the Father and his love for the world. That's what Francis did. And more men, and then Claire of Assisi, who watched him from the tower of her home and fled to him in the middle of the night. You know, they romanticized, like she eloped to meet Francis. Oh, well, she ran away from home is what she did because they had her all lined up to marry some count or something. And she herself was a religious soul. She was a spiritual woman. She was only 14 or 15 years old, but she knew she belonged to God, nobody else. But then women joined her sister, her mother, they joined her. But she became the cloistered branch. That's the second order. Francis is the first. She's the second. And then all the women who were either married or single or wanted to stay in the world and live a Franciscan way of life became the third order. And that's where Francis really found why we say he founded the three orders, because all three of them are flow from his own spirituality.
Well, you keep bringing it back to something that I think is really important. I mean, you hear a word like Franciscan, and it feels so obscure to, if you've never heard it before, it's like, what does that mean? Like, you know, don't we all, you know, if you're a Christian, don't you just want to follow Christ? Like, why bring Francis, Claire into this? Francis and Claire, they make it simple. And the way they followed Christ is just so countercultural and profound. Anyway, you keep bringing it back to that. And I appreciate that because like, I really think, and that was, my understanding is that was the appeal then too, is that, I mean, they're not necessarily doing anything that hasn't been done before, but they're living in a way that perhaps had been neglected or forgotten in how people perceived what it meant to follow Christ.
And what I think is, Francis was like new on the scene, sort of like he had a unique appeal. His way of walking through life and his way of honoring God and his interaction with people, his connection with nature. I mean, Benedictines, they existed, you know, the Dominicans, they existed, you know, all at the same time. There is a charism for every congregation. You know, I like to think about it, it's sort of like nature, you know, you have daisies and you have roses and you have plain old grass, you know. So it's, and some people will prefer a daisy. I remember going to a friend's wedding and she carried a bouquet of daisies in. You know, another friend would have a bouquet of roses, you know, but it's what you find attractive, what draws you. God says that gives you the vocation and God draws you through the vocation. So the author is God. And just as God has created this wildly diverse universe, starting with our world, which is complex and beautiful, and so many different animals and so many different plants and different people and different approaches to the way they live their life. That's the way it was with God and all of nature. And so I think Francis was the right man at the right time in God's plan.
From Sister Rosemary's book, there's a beautiful sentence that I'd like to talk about. It goes, "For Franciscans, the focus or gaze is not upward, but rather outward, or ordinary human life. Our gaze, our focus is not upward, but outward, toward one another, towards all of creation, towards all of our fellow humans." What does this mean for my faith and your faith? I think for Franciscans, this means that we enter into ongoing conversion by being in relationship with one another. There's a famous phrase that says, if you think you're enlightened, go spend a week with your family. Well, Franciscan spirituality is something like that, in that our family members, our friends, people that we live in community with, they're our best teachers because they are the ones that we have to live with and manage our daily lives with. They're also the people whose hands our ongoing conversion rests. There's a great example of this in Francis of Assisi's talking about his encounters with the lepers. His ongoing conversion was really sought after, was really developed within relationship with lepers. We know that as a young man, he reviled the lepers. He made fun of them. He ridiculed them. He made nasty gestures at them. He couldn't stand the sight or the smell of them. He would run away, not even the sight of them. He wouldn't get that close. He'd run away before he could see a leper. And yet, we know that in time, there was something that changed in him. He turned around and encountered a leper and was willing to face him face to face, eye to eye. In time, he lived among the lepers, served them, and they served him. In what way? Perhaps they didn't prepare his meals for him. Maybe they did. But by being there, by being present, he cultivated this capacity to be present with those very people he had reviled. So the lesson here is for us to ask ourselves, who are the lepers in our own lives? Who's the leper in my life? Who are those people that I've run away from, I don't want to engage in, I don't even want to look at? And is it possible to develop the capacity to be present, to be curious about their livelihood, about who they are, why they think the way they do, why they do things the way they do? And in that developing relationship, is it possible to see our own opening of heart, our own ongoing conversion developing? I think this is at the heart of the Franciscan spiritual movement, and really is at the heart of this phrase that Sister Rosemary brings forward. For Franciscans, the focus and gaze is not upward, but rather outward toward ordinary human life. In our relationships with one another, that our conversions develop, our faith develops and strengthens, and we become more vulnerable and open-hearted in the process.
One aspect of Franciscan spirituality that you write about in your book that I wanted to dive into for a little bit is the idea of poverty. And of course, for Francis and Claire, it wasn't just an idea. I mean, it was a lived reality.
Yes.
And I liked your phrasing in the book. You described Franciscan poverty as a, quote, poverty of being. What do you mean by this phrase, and how do you think adopting a poverty of being can help each of us today? What, Christian or non-Christian, Franciscan or non-Franciscan? Like, I think there's something valuable here for each of us.
When I say poverty of being, I want to use that expression and kind of match it up to how we live poverty. And so when we say, there's poor people everywhere and they're miserable, and that shouldn't be because they're being deprived. Genuine poverty is a spiritual experience, that we recognize that we are nothing, that we are only alive because of the mercy and goodness and overwhelming transformative love of God, that God from all eternity wanted me, wanted you, wanted every human being to be born and to live and to have a life of service to the world and to God, and to have a role to play, to have something to contribute. You know, I talk to the students always about what is your mission in life. And they'll say, well, that's your job, isn't it? You are the mission director. But no, you also have a mission. And what will that be? And how will you live it? And how will you know what it is until you find it? How do you discern? What is discernment? How do you do discernment? You know, there's a million ways that you could go with that. But I also think poverty of being is, above all else, a yearning to be like Christ in his poverty. And what does that mean? Not that he didn't have a mother, father, food on the table. His poverty was that he left the glory of his the Father's side. He was the Son of God, the pinnacle of anything that any human person would want to have. That he was sent by the Father to the earth to become a human person, to live among us, to experience our life. But for what purpose? So that we, being transformed by Christ, could go back to the Father and have the same status as Christ with the Father. Like, his humanity comes down to our humanity, and our humanity goes back up to the Father after death to be with him in his humanity, one with the Father within the Trinity. And that, to me, was, I didn't know how else to explain it except to say, you know, it's from within.
Yeah, because I think when some people hear that word, like poverty, like you mentioned, I mean, real physical poverty, like that's an evil, you yes. know, like people should have their basic needs met, especially in this country.
Yes.
I mean, with all of our wealth and opportunities here. However, you're talking about something else. If I'm hearing you correctly, poverty of being can actually be liberating.
Absolutely.
Then you stop chasing things. Then you stop trying to grasp at things. You know, then you stop trying to control your life. And you mentioned that trajectory of the divine, God coming to us, and then divinization, you know, us becoming more like God. This kenosis, this kenotic kind of movement of letting go, self-emptying. For me in my own life, it began to make more, like Franciscan poverty began to make more sense to me when I began to put it in the context of, what are the things in my life I'm trying so desperately to control? Okay. It's time to let that go and trust that I am becoming more like Christ in this letting go. Mm-hmm. You know, that something is
Absolutely.
Happening on a deeper level for me. My heart is being formed. My mind is being formed. And that's, for me, that's like one element of Franciscan poverty. Do you have any thoughts there?
I think actually you're paraphrasing what I said to Stephen almost better than I said it to.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
It's coming from you as a person searching, you know, and I'm a person searching too, but my understanding of it is not always, I mean, that's not when I entered and took the vows for the first time. That's not what I thought I was. I knew poverty, I was going to give up, you know, having fancy clothes, because at that time we were wearing habits and veils, and we were, you know, it was all the traditional religious lifestyle. But But poverty, I didn't mind it. It wasn't something that I mourned over, you know, oh, I can never have my bike back. You know, I can't ride, you know, I can't, I don't have money to, I remember riding the train from Philadelphia back to our mother house here in Reading. And I didn't even have a dime in my pocket to make a phone call if I needed to. And I mean, those days are long gone, of course, but, you know, and it never bothered me. But again, I was young and everybody else was doing it. And so it was my lot to do it too. But for me, poverty as chastity, as obedience, has been a struggle and a joy, a greater understanding of its purpose and meaning. And as I see it matched to how Christ lived, obedient to the Father, humble and poor, and a total love for humanity in all of its sinfulness and in all of its glory. And so, you know, each time I think about, you know, I make retreats and I go, you know, away for spiritual direction and, you know, all of the above, you can never have enough and you can never find that, okay, now I've got it all. Now I don't have to worry about it. I could just sit back and relax and live it out. No, it's an ongoing journey and it just always keeps getting deeper.
Yeah. And it's a huge thing in our culture because it seems like so often we are always looking for that thing to fill us. And that can be material we see this a lot these days. That can be ideological too. You know, like we're looking for that thing that answers all of our questions. We're looking for that thing that gives us ultimate certainty so that we can be right and holy and look down. That's the egoic aspect, so that we can look down on others. Franciscan poverty says, like, let that go. Let that go. Like, in the emptiness, only in that disorienting emptiness can God be the one that fills us.
Exactly. And that's the purpose of poverty. It's not poverty as a value, isn't a value, really. Poverty as a vow isn't to make you feel lower and hungry or, you know, imperfect or even just a failure. Poverty is to free you to do all those things you've mentioned and to keep on going even further and faster to the God who created you and is calling you home.
Yeah, I love that. That's beautiful. And of course, you mentioned it earlier, but, you know, the notion of poverty, and that brings us to the humility of God, the title of Sister Elia Delio's book. And in the Franciscan approach to the incarnation, you mentioned this in your book, this is a big theological element that kind of sets Franciscans apart, correct? I mean, you mentioned Duns Scotus. You've got a great section in your book where you go through all these notable Franciscans through the centuries, and each section is kind of an on-ramp to further explore them if you want to. And Scotus, of course, came along and he refuted St. Anselm's popular atonement theory, which is basically the idea that God became man in order to die for our sins. And Scotus argued that the incarnation would have still happened even if Adam and Eve had not sinned.
Exactly.
And yes. I mean, this may seem like a wacky kind of interpretation of the incarnation to many Christians listening to this, who have only heard as sin as the explanation for the incarnation. However, can you discuss where Scotus was coming from and how this was actually not a new idea and the Franciscans were bringing forth something that was actually quite ancient and perennial in the Christian tradition?
We'll try, Stephen.
Yeah. It's a big question.
Yeah, I know.
We're just talking about God becoming human. No big deal.
Actually, you know, I read Scotus and I admire him. I understand what he's trying to say, but sometimes to be able to articulate it back to you, I want to do it justice. So, you know, I'm not a scholar from, you know, in that particular era, but neither was Francis a scholar. So what I see in Francis and how Scotus perceived it was that Francis followed the inspiration of God. He built his whole life around Jesus Christ. He created the Bethlehem scene because he wanted to replicate what the Lord did. Then his whole, he was a common man. He was a simple man. He was one of the people of the city. And all he was trying to do was help them see God the way he saw God in all these little manifestations of picturesque little scenarios, you know. And the fact that he had the stigmata, the fact that, you know, and he tried to conceal it. At the end of his life, he suffered terribly from it. He was going blind, and they cauterized his eyes, which did nothing but cause him pain. And he was singing as they did it, and he said he felt nothing. But, of course, he did, being human, but he transcended it in his mind, in his heart. He was so one with God that he could feel only God's love, even though his body was in pain. You know, and I think this is what SCOTUS is trying to say in some way, that that Christ Jesus is one of us. He lived among us, and he died just like a man who was rejected by the world, and that was part of the plan of the Father in so far as it had something to do with the redemption of the human race.
John Duns Scotus developed a theology around the spiritual insights of Francis and Claire. With regard to the incarnation, his view was that God so loved the world, he wanted to take on human flesh to live among humanity, to share divine life with humanity and all of creation through the incarnation, through Christ coming into this world. Now, this might seem a little different than what many of us grew up with. Many of us grew up with a view of the incarnation that's similar to Anselm, his theology of the atonement, that because humans sinned, there needed to be a debt paid, and the debt was paid with the life of Jesus, of the passion of Christ. Because this theology is so embedded in many of us, when we hear SCOTUS's theology, we think it's an innovation, we think it's new, we think it's different. But in fact, it was centuries old. Theologians who had argued for a positive anthropology, a positive reason for the incarnation. For example, Isaac of Syria, he died around 700. He argued that the birth of Christ was the most happiest thing that could possibly happen in the world. So to attribute it to human sin would be ridiculous. Instead, it revolves around God's love for all of creation. God became incarnate so that the world would become aware of God's love as God dwelt among us. So for me, because it was an innovation to me, I didn't grow up with this kind of theology. In recent years, I've kept a nativity scene at my desk. Some people walk into my study and say, "Hey, it's not Christmas time, why do you have a nativity set?" For me, it is a constant reminder that the incarnation is a part of my faith, not just in December, not just December 25th or into January, but all year round, that the incarnation is evidence of God's love among us. And this is a very Franciscan approach.
I think that's what drew me to the Franciscan tradition, it is so positive, you know, like usually in religion, it's guilt and shame that gets you in the door because you're just trying to feel better about yourself. And then that ends up being some kind of manipulating force to keep bringing you back again. However, Francis is saying, like, yeah, look outside, God's there.
Yes, exactly.
You know, like, listen to your dog whimpering right now. Bring me back to my dog. Like,
yeah,
God's there. The overflowing, and I know Bonaventure would go into this with the fountain fullness, this overflow of love and goodness that has been perpetually flowing from the very beginning of reality. It's everywhere. And we get to enter into that flow and experience it. That's a different kind of grace. And not to say that, like, we certainly, the sacrament of confession is a great is a great thing. And, you know, to talk about your wrongdoings and mistakes, like I'm not advocating for, you know, leaving that out of spirituality. However, I'm saying that in the Franciscan way, it feels deeper to me that it's not always the thing that brings you to the throne room. You know, like you go there because it's so beautiful and loving.
Exactly.
And yeah.
Exactly. I like that.
And that brings us to another element that you hit on in your book, and that's the concept of relationality. Concept sounds way too dry. Like, again, for Francis and Claire, it was like lived experience. But relationality, of course, it comes out very clearly in Francis's Canticle of the Creatures, which turns 800 years old this year, but also throughout his life, as you mentioned, through his relationship with creation, with lepers, with outsiders, people on the margins, and even in his approach to death, like he called death sister death.
Yeah.
Even that was relational.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. But can you delve into this notion for me as you understand it as a Franciscan, and how the Franciscan way kind of helps to elevate something that has perhaps been neglected in Christianity and in the church, and that is this intimate relationality of the universe and our partnership in it?
Yeah. I sometimes think that we try to separate divinity and humanity. We compartmentalize them. Francis did not. He united them. And that's why I think it's so attractive, because we suddenly find ourselves with God, not trying to figure out who God is and how we can find him. We are with him. He's within us. So that relationality with all of creation is just like a tight bud that opens up into a flower. You know, it's that you don't even know what the flower is going to look like when it's only a bud. But when that opens up, it's just magnificent. And I think that Francis had special gifts from God. He was called from birth. He was a unique child. He was joyous and friendly and fun. And he had his sufferings, and he had his traumatic moments, and he had his failures, and he understood, you know, the lowly place he had in humanity, like everybody else. But in some ways, he was able to transcend from one level to another And he kept on going, and God's grace and mercy called him, and he responded. And God poured more on Francis because Francis responded so beautifully. And God had a plan for Francis. He knew the impact Francis was going to have on society. I mean, you know, in his own time, he had so many followers. But it wasn't just that. It was that each follower was so imbued with the spirit of Francis that they all went out and they affected the world. And so relationality and the interaction of many people, I think Francis becomes for them the harbor. You know, they're adrift on the ocean. There's nobody coming. They can't find their way back. There's no lighthouse. And suddenly they find Francis, and he's the anchor. He's the shore they've been trying to find so that they could land their boat and start to live. And that life springs up in them, and they develop like a flower, really. They become kind. They become helpful. They become compassionate. And as they grow in love for Francis, Francis leads them right to the Father, right to Jesus. And the graces are what awaken us. It's not just the human person. It's the grace we receive from our opening ourselves to God in the way that Francis did, that enables us to begin to grow and to develop and to become our own person on our own personal quest. But he's out there being our leader.
Yeah, well, that brings me to something Francis said when he was dying. And he said, "May Christ teach you what is yours to do." You summarize it as this, quote, "Each person is called by God to fulfill a particular mission," end quote. And the uniqueness of the Imago Dei in each person, and I know you you're having conversations like this all the time with the students there at Alvernia. It is a liberating thing to awaken more to how deeply connected you already are, you know, to the divine all around. And then I think that this brings us into a sense of mission, that because you realize who you are and you're loved and you are made in the image of God and you do have a unique purpose. And in your quirks and uniqueness, your particularity is, SCOTUS would say, I mean, your hexaity, like these are things that God has gifted you with. It's part of you. I think the Franciscan tradition, it really brings forth that notion of the Imago Dei. And I'm curious how you approach that in your work today at Alvernia.
That's a great great question, because Stephen, when I speak, I spoke about the search class and I speak to the students, every section of the search class. And what I do, not only do I share with them a little bit about the Bernardine history, Bernardine sisters and how we were founded and so on, but the other half of it at least talks about the mission. And we have as our mission to learn, to love, to serve, which is the part of, it's right out of Bonaventure, you know, and it's a famous quote from Bonaventure about, you know, knowledge joined with love and all of that. So I explain what that means. And then I show them all the little plaques that hang in the buildings on campus, especially the residence halls, Claire Hall, Francis Hall, Bonaventure Hall, you know, and then we have some of the sisters named some of the halls for them. And then I talk about the San Damiano cross and how that's in every building because of where it comes from and how it's important. But then I tell them, most importantly, is when you graduate from Alvernia, and I show them the seal. And on the seal, in Latin, of course, is the saying, I have done my part. May Christ show you what is yours to do. And I said, when you graduate from Alvernia, and you have had all these courses, and you've had the experience of listening to all the faculty prepare you for life, and you now know what the spirituality is, the foundation point, what's the spiritual basis for this university was instilled in, was developed as part of the evolution of the university. The Bernardine Franciscan sisters, with Francis as their patron, developed a model which would help students live a life that would give them not just wealth and fame and maybe even make a life, but would give them purpose and would help them find their way through a troubled society and reach out to a God who loves them, regardless of faith, regardless of no faith at all. And I make that very clear, because we are always a Catholic university welcoming all faiths. And then I say to them, God will show you what is yours to do. And that is what your focus needs to be. Hold on to the hand of God. You know, and one time I was talking to a group of students and I said, just remember three things. You know, remember I hope I get the three of them right now. The first one was never forget your roots. And the second one was never turn your back on the poor. And the third was never let go of the hand of God. And I said, if you just write that down and keep it as a bookmark in a prayer book someplace, or whenever you feel lonely or lost and you want to say a prayer to God, pull that out. If you just do those three things, you'll be okay. You'll find your way home.
Thank you for your time, Sister Rosemary. This has been a real joy. Is there anything we left out or anything else you wanted to hit on before we conclude here?
Maybe this is what I can share. I want the students to start a podcast through campus ministry, and that's where I'm working now. I think that students are hungry for God. They want to know more. They don't know how to ask the right. They're afraid to ask the question, to be labeled. It's like they talk to each other, but they're kind of stumbling around and they don't know, you know. And I think that if we had students who understood certain things well, and they were running a podcast like you're running this podcast with me, there would be such it would be such a help for them spiritually.
Yeah. I mean, the whole podcast phenomenon, as I mentioned to you in a previous call that we had, was it's kind of baffling, but it's what you said. I mean, I think people are, despite all the stats you see about people's connection to an organized religion, people are really hungry for depth. I've never said this on the podcast before, but this podcast is called Off the Page. And it's a multidimensional kind of meaning, because You know, typically we think of when you read God's word, and this goes back to our mutual friend, Father Dan Riley, typically you think that, okay, that just pertains to scripture, reading God's word. And it certainly does. However, that also takes us off the page into the world, as Francis did.
Perfect.
To read the world before us and to enjoy this reading and to get lost in this reading. And so it's kind of a play on words with also, we're interviewing a lot of authors, so we're going off the page with them. Our ultimate hope is that, at least mine, is that it guides listeners off the page in their own life to go out in the world and open up to the God that is right before them all along, wanting to, as you said, hold their hand. So I as we conclude here, I was curious, and if nothing comes to mind, that's okay. But toward the end of your book, I loved that you included a number of beautiful prayers that are important to the Franciscan tradition. So as we bring this to a close, I was wondering if you would mind either reciting or reading a prayer that means a lot to you. And if you don't mind, could you, before you read it, could you tell us why it's so important to you on a personal level?
You don't mind if I use the book as a prompt?
That's fine. It's your book. You do what you want.
Yes. The prayers, you know, it's interesting how I found things to put into the book. For example, I did a little piece on Pope Francis. I just think that this man is so wonderful. He's just a gift to humanity at the time we needed him. And I didn't know what I would say, but I just started to write it. And it all just came out just the way I hardly even changed it. A letter in the whole expression of it, but that's sometimes, you know, it just sometimes something hits you very significantly. There is a prayer that we sing as Bernardine Franciscan sisters. It's called Tota Pulchra, and it's all pure. That's what it means. Tota all pulchra, beautiful. You are all fair, O Mary. You are all fair, and the original stain is not in you. You are the glory of Jerusalem. You are the joy of Israel. You are the honor of our people. You are the advocate of sinners. O Mary, Virgin most prudent, Mother most merciful, pray for us. Intercede for us with our Lord Jesus Christ. In your conception, O Virgin, you are immaculate. Pray for us to the Father, whose Son you have born. And we sing that prayer in Latin every Saturday because our congregation, as was all, is with all Franciscans, we are very devoted to the Mother of God. And so that prayer has a special part of the book, and it's especially in my heart.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for sharing it with us. And thank you again for your time, Sister Rosemary.
You're
this
welcome.
Was a joy.
It was a joy to be with you too, Stephen.
Once again, that was Sister Rosemary Stutz. Her book, Franciscan Field Guide, is available on our website, Amazon, or wherever books are sold. If you feel inclined, please consider leaving a review of this podcast or visiting the donation link in the show notes to help us continue to hopefully create content like this that accompanies you on your spiritual journey. Thanks again to Sister Rosemary, to Dr. Darlene Prides, and thanks as well to Father Cyprian Concilio for providing the intro and outro music for this episode. This is Stephen Copeland signing off. Peace and all good.